fossilized prints.
That's the scientist's best hypothesis, anyhow. With more evidence, they might be able to tell if pterosaurs used runways to take off as well as land.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear, with help from Blair Van Valkenburg at UCLA. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amomentofscience.org, where you can also sign up for podcasts and view videos. For A Moment of Science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:41. In sports, Notre Dame has fired coach Charlie Weiss after a string of disappointing seasons that was capped by an agonizing four-game losing streak. Athletic director Jack Swarbrick announced the decision this afternoon, saying that they have great expectations for the football program, and they haven't been able to meet those expectations. Swarbrick says he recommended to the university president last night that Weiss be let go with 6 years left on his contract. Assistant head coach Rob Ianello will step in for Weiss until a new head coach is hired. After a 6-2 start, the losing streak began as it progressed through Weiss's future was in doubt. Weiss finishes 35-27 in 5 seasons at Notre Dame, worse than his two predecessors, Tyrone Willingham and Bob Davie. Meanwhile, Oklahoma coach Bob Stoops says he fully intends to be at Oklahoma for a good while, amid rumors that he could be a candidate for the Notre Dame job. Stoops is coming off the worst regular season in his 11 years with the Sooners. He has led Oklahoma, though, to 7 BCS games and 1 national championship. Tiger Woods has withdrawn from his own golf tournament after citing injuries from a car crash near his home in Florida. Woods said in a statement on his website that injuries won't allow him to play in the Chevron World Challenge. He says he would return to competition next year. His decision to withdraw comes after a car crash left him with cuts and bruises when his SUV hit a fire hydrant and a tree. Kansas is within 2 votes of being a unanimous number 1 in the AP Men's College Basketball poll, the same week that a record-tying 7 teams moved into the top 25. Illinois was one of the teams that dropped out of the rankings this week. It's not even December, and Indianapolis Colts coach Jim Caldwell is already hearing the annual questions about resting starters before the end of the season. Caldwell won't say what strategy he'll use over the final 5 games of the season, but he did say today the team's coaching staff and front office are considering what to do if the unbeaten Colts lock up the AFC's top seed. Until then, Caldwell says it's business as usual. And that's a look at sports.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation at 5th and John Streets in Champaign, a welcoming and inclusive community living out a progressive approach to faith. McKinley Church's schedule of Christmas season services is available online at mckinley-church.org.
It's 2:43 on the Afternoon Magazine. Voters in Atlanta choose a new mayor in a runoff election tomorrow, and it's expected to be very close. The race features a woman who could become the city's first white mayor in more than 3 decades, and a former state senator who has the support of many African-American civil rights leaders. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
Mary Norwood, who is white, received 46% of the vote in November. She is a 2-term city councilwoman who calls herself the candidate of change. Recently, Norwood campaigned at the Shamrock Gardens Apartments. Once filled with crime and drugs, the area was renovated into affordable housing. Resident Desiree Purnell says Norwood understands the community.
If you want to see a change, whether it's black or white, Amen. It's about who's going to do the job. Right. It's about quality of life and education. Amen. It's about everybody getting a chance.
Norwood's opponent is former state senator Kasim Reed, who is African American. He has received support from much of Atlanta's black power structure, including former mayor Andrew Young, who posted a video online. Civil rights icon Joseph Lowry also publicly endorsed Reed, and Reed accepted in front of the historic King Center.
The torch has been passed. And that is so important because we must understand the sacrifices that have been made so that I can be sitting right here. And I want you to know that I do. I'm ready to lead.
Reed was the current mayor, Shirley Franklin's campaign manager, and he recently got her endorsement as well. But that may not necessarily help him. Reed and Norwood are both campaigning on reducing crime and on making City Hall accountable. Reed's latest TV ad focuses on the issue.
It's not about playing politics. It's actually about moving this city forward.
Because Kasim will clean up the mess in City Hall.
He cares about people.
Tuesday, Kasim Reed. New leadership for a new direction.
Norwood and her staff have downplayed race, but her most recent television ad raises the issue.
Well, some people are trying to divide our city along racial lines, but whether we are white or black, live on the north side or the south side, we are one city, and we need to have one government.
In the final mayoral debate last night, Reed asked Norwood to explain her ad.
When you make a charge in an ad that you send out over the airwaves and you say some people are attempting to divide our city, I think that you should be courageous enough to say who those individuals are. And if you don't, you owe the people of Atlanta an apology after 18 months that we have spent trying to keep a high-minded campaign.
Norwood promised to provide information to Reed's campaign. Reed also charged Norwood has not done enough over her past 8 years on the city council. But Norwood shot back she has fought for residents without help from the current administration.
There are things that I was not able to get, Mr. Reed, because I was not the insider. I have been the outsider fighting for our citizens and fighting for our neighborhoods for years.
Atlanta is 56% African American, and this is the closest mayoral race the city has seen in decades. The latest polls show the race is a statistical dead heat. Michael Leo Owens is a political scientist at Emory University.
Atlanta is a city that is very queasy about discussing the issue of race. Because, of course, to bring up the issue of race kind of goes against the longstanding idea that Atlanta is a city that's too busy to hate.
Ultimately, the key will be which candidate can get its voters to go back to the polls on Tuesday. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
Beekeeping is a growing hobby. Here are even a couple of hives on the White House lawn, and beekeeping is even getting popular in America's largest and most urban city, New York. The only problem is beekeeping is actually illegal in New York. Samara Freemark of the Environment Report went to find out why some New Yorkers are doing it anyway.
When I first got in touch with the Gotham City Honey Co-op, they were a little nervous about talking with me. They were worried about a New York City health code that makes urban beekeeping illegal. The city's worried about people getting stung. And the Honey Co-op didn't want to blow anyone's cover. But eventually, they did hook me up with John Howe. Howe keeps bees on the roof of his Brooklyn townhouse, which means every day, several times a day, actually, he climbs 4 flights of stairs and 1 shaky ladder to get up to his hives.
Get up the ladder.
I'm getting tired of it.
Turned out to be a nice day.
We walk across Howe's roof, and we look at his 2 hives. Howe says there could be 150,000 bees in them.
You can see them all going in and out.
A lot of bees, yeah.
Now, honeybees can travel up to 3 miles from their hives as they fly around looking for flowers to pollinate. Howe's bees probably buzz by thousands of his neighbors every day. So I asked Howe if anyone ever complained about the bees or called authorities to turn them in for illegal beekeeping. Howe said, actually, not really.
People just shrug, raise their eyebrows and say, that's neat. They call me Bee Man. I walk down the street. Hey, Bee Man, you got any honey?
Across town, Roger Repal raises bees in the garden of a church in the South Bronx. Repal started beekeeping about 10 years ago when local gardeners noticed that their vegetables weren't getting pollinated.
The community gardeners were complaining that they were getting a lot of flowers but very little fruit. So Green Thumb, you know Green Thumb, that's the community gardening wing of the Parks Department. Green Thumb said, well, that's because you don't have enough pollinators in the South Bronx.
So Repal trucks some hives down from Vermont, and he says the bees pretty much solve the neighborhood's pollination problem. Now, this is the kind of story that gets beekeepers like John Howe totally steamed up about New York's anti-beekeeping laws. Like a lot of cities, New York is doing just about everything it can to encourage community gardening. But to grow your own food, you need insects to pollinate your plants. So John Howe says banning honeybees is kind of like banning local food.
The best reason for making bees legal is that they pollinate so many different plants. The more bees that we can raise and keep, the more chance we have of having food.
It's not quite that clear-cut. At least, that's what James Danoff Berg says. Berg studies insects at Columbia University, and he says there are native bugs that also do plenty of pollinating. Beetles, for example, and other kinds of bees like bumblebees. And those native species, they're being driven out by honeybees, which are imports from Europe.
I think that it's a mixed bag. They have benefits to people, for certain. And from a human perspective, if all that you're concerned about is that your plants are pollinated and you can get the fruits that come from that, then it's a pure positive bag. Right? The negative part of that mixed bag comes when you start to think about native biodiversity.
But Danoff Berg says preserving native biodiversity maybe doesn't matter quite so much in a place like New York. The city's ecosystem has already been changed so much, and there are other more wild places where native insects can thrive. So even though New York is America's biggest city, it might also be the best place in the country to raise bees, as long as you keep them out of sight of the law. For the Environment Report, I'm Samara Freemark.
Well, food writer Nigella Lawson knows that the upcoming holiday season can be overstuffed with planning and decorating, but she says there are ways to help keep things warm and simple. She has a new cookbook entitled Nigella Christmas, and she sat down with NPR's Renee Montaigne.
In her introduction, Nigella says that everything she believes about the kitchen, that it's a place to celebrate warmth and contentment and friendship, finds expression at Christmas. She joined us, as she does from time to time, from London. Good morning.
Hello.
So pretty nice time then, if sort of everything that the kitchen is comes to fruition during the Christmas season.
Well, I think so, but I think that's partly because I sort of construct my holiday this season in a very informal way. For many people, it's quite stressful, but actually, because I like things to be relaxed, my idea of the Christmas period, the holidays, is friends over, food that maybe you've cooked in advance or else, you know, you can just serve very easily. And I suppose is comforting food rather than impressive, you know, status symbol food.
Well, we're going to talk about some of those recipes, but, you know, you say you want the house to be filled with people sitting around a table, talking and eating, as you've just said, but every single night.
Well, I don't mean every single night, but I certainly am very happy to do, you know, 3 nights a week, because I feel somehow people are so predisposed, I'd say, to having a good time. It makes one want to invite them. I also tend to do, I suppose, slightly earlier suppers, and I invite whole families together. So I suppose it sounds like I'm saying have a dinner party every night, but really I'm just saying have people round.
Well, let's talk about one of the dishes that you might serve or have on hand at one of those gatherings in December, chocolate chip chili. What makes it perfect for Christmastime entertaining?
Well, I think there are various things. In terms of, you know, what makes it perfect for the cook, it's that you can cook it in advance. And that really means that when your friends come over, you've got everything dealt with. And I suppose there's something about chili which is such a classic, but a classic of the cozy kitchen, that it makes people feel looked after. And I do think that, you know, at this time of year, people are probably going to drink more than they might at other times of the year. So it somehow soaks up any seasonal excess. It's also slightly playful. It sounds odd to say, you know, put chocolate chips in your chili, but actually cocoa is used routinely. It just adds a kind of thickness and a velvetiness. So I suppose it's that. It's warming food, but it's family food.
So along with the chili, you would serve fully loaded potato skins. But that one does not say, you know, Christmas.
Well, I suppose it doesn't, in the sense that people would be pretty surprised if you served it on Christmas Day, although I would be overjoyed, and actually it would be rather fantastic in the days, you know, after Christmas. But I find it, I suppose, so indulgent, and I think that at Christmas and during the holidays, people allow themselves to sort of wallow in the sort of food that sometimes they might try and deny themselves. Again, this is a recipe that can be made in advance. You can bake the potatoes, you can scoop out their white flesh and mix it with the sour cream and cheese and chives and what have you, and just put them all back, and then keep them in the fridge. And when people come over, they just quickly popped in a hot oven. I mean, I tend to put bacon on them when I cook them for myself, and sometimes leave the bacon if there's a huge party of people, because I feel one probably should not make the vegetables anti-vegetarian.
Yeah, leave off the bacon then. But I must say that just when you described it, it sounded so lovely.
Well, it's a cold time of year, and it's also, I think, somehow we've got in our heads the idea that Christmas should be bejeweled and enormously formal, and we should go to great lengths to create spectacular dinners. Well, that may be very nice, but it's not reality, and that really makes people dread having any sort of entertaining planned, because it asks too much. And I think sometimes if you cook in a complicated way, your tension translates to your guests, and actually they'll have a much better time having chili and baked potatoes than they would if you did, you know, roast duck with a wild cherry sauce and then Winnie had to lie down and cry for a while.
Well, you suggest we end with your Christmas Rocky Road. And, you know, you already have a recipe for Rocky Road. So what makes this a Christmas recipe?
Oh, well, this is Christmas recipe because I have candied cherries in, which I feel is a kind of reference to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I also don't use the very plain cookies. I use Amaretti cookies. And there's a tradition in Britain, and I don't know if it's quite the same in the States, which is nuts, and Brazil nuts in particular, are very Christmassy, so I put Brazil nuts in. You know, you can see in the book that I do sort of pile it up in a rather camp Christmassy way with a lot of powdered sugar and a little plastic reindeer, but you don't have to do that. I think why this is Christmassy is because it's an indulgent dessert, and also you can make it and wrap it and tie it with a little bow, and it makes a great gift. And I'm a great believer in edible presents at Christmas. I think it's, in a way, an old-fashioned tradition, but one that probably should be resurrected.
Nigella Lawson's new cookbook is Nigella Christmas. And I guess it's okay to, at this point in time, because it's after Thanksgiving, wish you a Merry Christmas season.
Well, it's my first wish for this season, so I return it.
Nigella Lawson spoke with NPR Morning Edition host Renee Montaigne.
Earth and Sky.
You know, climate change is so profoundly important and complex. It is the challenge of our generation. Can the world learn to cooperate on this challenge?
You're listening to economist Scott Barrett of Columbia University. He's talking about the Copenhagen Climate Summit, scheduled to begin on December 7th. World leaders will try to craft an international climate treaty.
What would be a successful treaty would be if the agreement changed the way the countries behaved, if it caused countries to reduce their emissions, if it stimulated a technological revolution that made it possible for greater reductions to be achieved in the future.
An example from the past, said Barrett, is the Montreal Protocol, which in 1987 banned ozone-depleting chemicals worldwide. But those same chemicals were later found to also be greenhouse gases. A study published by